Chapter 14. Professor Lewis had carefully unrolled the map, still curled from 75 years spent in a metal tube tucked behind a rock in a polar bear exhibit. Now he read aloud the banner that ran along the right side. Der Fels ist stabil. Wären sich die Ventre. What does that mean? Quentin asked.
It means the rock is steady while the world turns, Lewis said. It was the official dedication given to this monastery in the Alps.
He turned his laptop around and showed them a picture of a snow-capped mountain. Nick bent down to look more closely at the screen. This is the rock?
It's a mountain called Fergen in the Swiss Alps, on the border with Italy, halfway between the Matterhorn and Testa Grigia. Elevation well over 10,000 feet.
I don't see a monastery, Nick said. The professor switched to another image, an old black-and-white photograph of a crude wooden building.
This is the Fergen Monastery, built around the turn of the century. The only access was a set of cable cars, one running from the town of Brule-Chevinia to a midway station named Plan Maison, then another car from Plan Maison to the top of Fergen.
So if we take the cable cars up to Fergen, Nick said, how many Swiss police officers will be waiting for us? Or the Brotherhood's men? Or maybe this time it will be both.
The monastery was abandoned shortly after the war, Lewis said. A few years after that, an ice storm brought down the cable lines. So the good news is, for once there won't be anybody else waiting for you when you get up there.
I have a feeling there's going to be some bad news now, Nick said. Professor Lewis brought up another image, a more recent photo of the abandoned building. In several spots, the roof had caved in from the weight of the ice and snow. He kept scrolling through more photos, wider aerial shots of the upper sections of the mountain. The towers where the cables once ran were now empty. There was nothing else surrounding the monastery but sheer walls of rock and ice.
The bad news is, Lewis said, there's no way to get up there.
Early the next morning, they all gathered outside the motel. There was a cold edge to the pre-dawn air. All five members of the team packed into the stolen Honda, a tight fit with Professor Lewis wedged into the back with Nick and Kate. The drive would be 10 hours across Austria, through the tiny nation of Liechtenstein into Switzerland, then finally through a pass in the Alps to the Italian border. Even though the monastery itself was on Swiss soil, or rather on Swiss rock, the cable car leading halfway up Fergen was based in the town of Brule-Chevinia in the Aosta Valley, the very northwest corner of Italy. When they were safely out of Vienna, and with the sun coming up behind them from the east, the team stopped in the Austrian city of Sankt Pölten. They abandoned the stolen car in the center of town, leaving a couple of €100 in the glove compartment, and Nick used one of his fake passports and many more euros to rent a much larger and more comfortable Peugeot 5008. Then they settled in for 8 more hours of driving.
I don't understand why this next link is in such a remote place, Kate said when they stopped for a quick lunch. Everywhere else has been such a major landmark.
You raise an interesting point, Lewis said, a man who clearly lived for discussing interesting points. Of course, these links were hidden 75 years ago, so perhaps you're looking at this through a different cultural filter.
Kate just looked at him.
It may have seemed like more of a major landmark back then, he continued.
A monastery, hidden away on the top of a mountain.
Or, I have another theory, Lewis said. You realize that every place we've been so far has been in the former Axis-occupied nations of Europe. Well, we started in the Vatican. Which is in the middle of Rome, Lewis said. But let's not split hairs.
Fair enough, Kate said. Go on.
Whoever hid these clues couldn't have done so in the middle of Switzerland, because that country was, of course, neutral. Although let's be clear about that. Hitler absolutely despised Switzerland, and if the plans for Operation Tannenbaum had ever been executed, Germany and Italy would have invaded and they would have broken Switzerland into 2 pieces. It's actually a fascinating story,
how Hitler and Mussolini met in secret to draw up...
Professor, Kate said. Your theory?
Of course, he said. My theory is that there may have been an extra special reason to pick such a remote place for this link, in a country where, technically, the person hiding it was not even officially allowed to go. What I'm trying to say is that in all the years I've been doing academic research, I've learned to trust this little voice in my head. In fact, my entire doctoral thesis was based on an idea I had when I was in the shower, and it occurred to me that...
And that little voice is saying something to you now?
Yes, that voice is telling me that this may be the last link in the chain.
Everyone absorbed this. Quentin nodded and pursed his lips in a grim smile.
That's good to hear, Professor Lewis. But that same voice is also telling me that this link was meant to be the hardest of all. If you think about it, it's on the top of a mountain, with a group of monks who back then were probably not all that accommodating to strangers.
Unlike the polar bears, Quentin said, they were quite welcoming.
Hey, they invited us in for dinner, didn't they? Nick broke in. We just happened to be on the menu.
The professor pressed on.
I don't know what could be more dangerous than polar bears, but I'm afraid that if you insist on going up there, you might find out.
6 hours and 3 countries later, they reached the town of Breuil-Chavinia. It had originally been known by the French name of Breuil, then was renamed Chavinia in 1939 when the fascists were Italianizing all of the town names in the Aosta Valley. Now it went by both names joined together, the ultimate alpine ski resort town, a place that would have taken Kate's breath away if she wasn't there on such dead serious business. The world would have been bustling during the winter, but was still half full in the late summer with the more dedicated year-round skiers hitting the nearby Plateau Rosa Glacier. The sun was just starting to touch the mountaintops as they got out of the car and stretched their legs, looking up at the vast peaks of the Matterhorn and Testa Grigia, and between them, like a forgotten middle child, Fergan.
I don't see any extra police here, Nick said, looking all around him at the shops and lodging places. Doesn't mean we're still not being watched.
Let's take the gondola, Kate said. See what it looks like up there.
The gondola from Breuil-Chavinia led up to the Pleine Maison station, where it connected to other cars leading farther into the mountains, one to Theodule Pass, another to the Plateau Rosa Glacier and Testa Grigia. Most of the traffic at this time of day was summer skiers on their way down. Going up, the team had a car to themselves. It was a slow 8-minute ride, a rough trip with the car bouncing up and down on the cable. Kate went over to stand with her father as he looked down at the rocks and snow passing beneath them.
I parachuted into a monastery once, Kate said to her father. Remember?
Of course. I arranged the drop for you. It had been on the Greek island of Athos, when Nick Fox had escaped from custody and Kate had traveled halfway around the world to find him. That was the night she learned that Nick hadn't escaped at all, but rather had been recruited to work for the FBI. Finding him had been her test. To this day, she couldn't decide if acing that test had been the best move of her life, or the worst. A lot has happened since then, Jake said, seeming to read her mind. Look at the two of you now.
Yeah, I'm still trying to stay on top of him. Not the easiest job in the world.
Nope, he said, glancing at the scenery outside the window. Nick's a lucky man to have you.
I was asking about parachuting into that other monastery for a reason, Kate said.
Forget it, Kate. That was an island. Large target area, plenty of open ground. This is a mountain with nothing on top but an abandoned building half buried in ice. Not to mention the wind up there. A jump would be suicide. So would trying to land a helicopter.
As opposed to what, Dad?
Free climbing the Matterhorn?
The Matterhorn's over there, Jake said, nodding toward the west.
But I get your point. It may be suicide either way.
We're here, Kate said as the gondola started to grind to a halt. Let's go see.
They all walked through the Pleine Maison station and grabbed a quick bite to eat at the restaurant. There was also a small hotel attached to the station, accessible only by the gondola. Quentin found a north-facing window and stood there staring at the forlorn, empty towers that had once held the car leading up to Fergen. The towers looked like long-lost artifacts from another age. Jake came to stand next to him, then Kate and Nick, and finally Professor Lewis. "It's another 1,000 feet of elevation to reach the monastery," Nick said. "This isn't ladder ropes and grappling hooks anymore. This is the real thing." "We're going to need equipment," Kate said. "This is my favorite part of every adventure," Nick said. "Let's go shopping." They reserved 3 rooms at the hotel connected to the station, figuring it would give them a head start the next morning, then took the gondola back down to Broil-Chavinia and poked through the shops until they found one that carried serious climbing gear. The shop owner was about to close for the day, but Nick flashed an American Express black card, and the man was suddenly a lot more agreeable to delaying his dinner. The team outfitted themselves with full winter outfits, spiked mountaineering boots, harnesses, helmets, carabiners, pitons, ice screws, ice axes, and lots of climbing rope. Jake stood staring at a large topographical map mounted to the wall, showing the local mountain range in fine detail. Nick came to stand next to him. "What do you see?" he asked Jake. "I see 2 ways to go," Jake said, glancing over at the shop owner to make sure he was occupied with something else. "From Pleine Maison, it's a straight shot up the old gondola line. We can use the old towers as waypoints." "This way," Nick said, tracing the line up the map from the hotel to Fergen. "Exactly," Jake said. "The alternate is to come at it from the Swiss side. Start in Zermatt, then climb up to the ridge. Once you're up there, it's a traverse across the ridge to Fergen." "Advantages?" "It's an easier climb from Zermatt," Jake said, "especially once you're on the ridge. But it would take a lot longer, unless you take a snowcat. Problem is, a snowcat could be suicide on the narrow ridge. Going up on the Italian side is much steeper, but also much shorter." Nick nodded his head, studying the map. "We're already on this side of the mountain, and I just spent a small fortune on climbing gear. I say we stick to the plan. How bad could it be?" Jake didn't have to think about it for long. "You have to ask." It was dark when they took their last ride of a very long day, back up to Pleine Maison Station. They met one more time in Professor Lewis's room, where he showed them the map link and the locator rune next to the banner. "I know we got our wires crossed on the last one," he said. "I overthought it and sent you looking for a gift, when it was really just the X symbol itself. I'm sorry about that." "No apologies," Nick said. "We couldn't have come this far without you." "I think my grandfather is looking down on me right now and smiling," Lewis said. "He's the reason I became a Germanic literature scholar in the first place."
"Was he a professor too?" Nick asked.
"No, he played the piano. But he was born in Germany and moved to London with my grandmother just before the war. He helped translate messages at Bletchley Park after the Enigma Code was broken. When my grandfather died, my father gave me all of his old favorite books that he had brought over from Germany, as many as he could fit in one suitcase. Wieland, Schiller, Goethe. That's how it started for me, learning the language so I could understand why my grandfather loved those books so much, even though he hated the people who had taken over his home country." "That's a great story," Nick said. "It's been an honor to be a part of this," Lewis said. "Hadn't the adventure of a lifetime. But promise me, you won't let me overthink things next time."
"We'll try to remember that," Nick said. "But for now, where's this next link?"
Lewis pointed to the rune on the map, which looked like a modern less-than sign. "This rune is called Canaanites. You see what it looks like, but it also represents a torch, meaning either fire or light."
"So maybe a fireplace," Nick asked.
"Good place to start," Lewis said. "In an old monastery on the top of an alpine mountain with no electricity,
I'm sure there are many fireplaces.
It'll be a piece of torta, Nick said.
In the gray pre-dawn hour, four figures left the hotel grounds heading north. An observer would have been curious to see them outfitted with climbing gear and heading in that direction. There were a handful of climbers who would take the gondolas up to the glacier, but rarely would they start here at Plan Maison. Because where would they possibly go? The ground here at 7,500 feet was soft snow with patches of semi-thawed ground peeking through. It was uneven and unpredictable, with one step that could be solid followed by another that could break an ankle by dropping a climber right through the snow. By the time they ascended another 3,000 feet, it would be nothing but solid ice, treacherous in a very different way.
"What's our risk of avalanche?" Quentin asked.
"Always a risk," Jake said. "You get powder avalanches in the winter, wet avalanches in the summer when the snow itself is heavier." Quentin looked back at Nick and Kate trailing behind them.
"You have an amazing daughter," Quentin said, "but you already know that."
Jake nodded.
"I do. Nick's mother has been gone for a while now, but I can't help wondering what she'd think of all this. Kate lost her mother, too. But I don't have to wonder what she'd think."
Quentin smiled.
"Olivia would have loved seeing Nick with someone like Kate. That much I can tell you.
I don't know how much they're with each other. I don't know if they even know themselves." They reached the first empty tower, about 200 yards north of the station. The slope wasn't very steep yet. They kept walking to the next tower. The slope increased.
"Wait here," Jake said. "I'll set a line at the next tower."
He climbed the next 200 yards, using the crampons on his boots for traction, and occasionally breaking out his ice axe for a little more help. When he reached the tower, he tied a line, then led it back to the rest of the group.
"You can't do this all the way up," Kate said when they reached the tower. "You'll wear yourself out. Let me take the next one."
"I have the most experience with this," Jake said.
"I wasn't asking," Kate said. "I'm up."
Jake shrugged, knowing he wouldn't win the argument. He untied the line and gave it to Kate. She set off for the next tower. The sun was coming up now, even as the air was getting colder. The slope of the terrain had not begun to punish them. Kate started to wonder if the whole climb would be this easy, took a step into some deep snow and painfully post-holed herself, her leg going all the way through. She climbed out, shook that off, kept going, and hit an ice patch a few yards farther, losing her footing and nearly hitting her face on the ice.
"Okay," she thought. "Not so easy."
She reached the next tower and tied the line, led it back, and almost wrecked herself a couple more times on the way.
"My turn," Nick said when she rejoined the group. "You guys are hogging all the fun."
"Fine with me," Kate said, handing him the rope.
Nick headed off for the next section, digging into the ice with his spikes, swinging his ice axe and then using the leverage to lift himself up a sheer wall at least 8 feet high, then scrambling up another incline until he reached the next tower. An old cable car had fallen and buried itself into the ice and frozen mud here. Nick was reasonably sure there were no skeletons trapped inside, yet he still didn't want to look through the hazy windows. He led the line back and told the rest of the group about the 8-foot wall and the fallen car just beyond it. The climb was already getting interesting, and they'd only been on the mountain for a little over an hour. Jake wouldn't let Quentin take the next section. He was already looking ahead to the next tower and how high it had been set into the rocks above them. The real climbing was about to begin. Jake worked his way up the steep incline, finding footholds and handholds in the rocks and ice, pounding in pitons every few yards, running the line through his harness so that if he fell, it would only be a miserable body slam and not an outright fatality. When he found the next tower, he saw that it had been damaged by an avalanche sometime over the years and was now tilting a good 30 degrees downslope. It was a good reminder that an avalanche could still happen at any moment. Jake fed down the line. He didn't even have to walk it back, the terrain was so steep.
The group made their way up, and then Kate took the next section. They all took a break after that, looking back down the mountain at the hotel far below them.
"Everybody's still up for this," Jake asked. "It's only going to get harder."
"Let's go," Kate said.
2 hours later, the mountain had spiraled them away to the east, away from their sightline down to the hotel. The empty towers were their only guideposts now. There were no more bare spots on the ground. Everything was either snow, ice, or some combination of the two, with the temperature just barely warm enough to occasionally thaw patches in the direct sunlight, which would freeze at night, thaw again, then refreeze. Jake knew that this could be even more dangerous than in the dead of winter, when everything was ice, and you never had to assume anything different. He was working his way up an almost sheer wall, at least 20 feet high, chopping into the ice and setting pitons every few feet. There was an overhang of snow above him. Jake kept his eye on it, wondering how he'd work his way over it, at the same time hoping today wasn't the day it would all come down at once. He glanced back at the others, all huddled together 100 yards behind him at the last tower. Then he looked back up and suddenly the whole world was rushing at him. He heard somebody shout from below before everything turned into pure white impact. Jake grabbed the ice axe, already planted into the wall, held onto it with both hands, and tucked his head in as much as possible as the snow and debris pounded his helmet and his shoulders and the back of his neck. It thundered in his ears, filling his jacket with snow and dirt and ice as he held on. He wondered if these would be his last moments on Earth, and wondered at the same time if his daughter and Nick and Quentin would be able to use the few extra seconds they had to climb up the tower, or if that would even matter at all. Maybe this was it. Right now. For all of them. And someone would find their bodies a month from now. Or a year from now. Or maybe never, if they were buried deep enough. The weight kept pounding down on him, feeling like the entire mountain was pouring itself onto his head. He felt his fingers start to slip from the axe. He couldn't hold on much longer. The debris was in his mouth now, his ears, his eyes, his nose. It would suffocate him before it crushed him. The roar somehow stopped. He was hanging by one hand, his face pressed against the ice. He spit everything out, shook his head, and turned to look down at the path of the debris. Most of it had settled down by the tower. More important, Kate, Nick, and Quentin were above it, holding on to the tower's legs. "Are you okay?" his daughter called up to him. He spit out more dirt and called back, "Never better." When he caught his breath, he continued his climb up the wall. The top was cleared of snow now and easier to crest than before it had tried to kill him. He saw the next tower ahead, another 50 yards away, with one more wall of ice to climb until he could reach his goal. For the first time on this whole trip, after everything they had been through, Jake asked himself if he was simply too old for this. He answered his own question, "Hell no," and kept climbing. Kate's hands were getting sore and blistered, even with the climbing gloves. She leaned her weight all the way back as she held on tight to the rope, using her feet to grip the ice and her legs to do most of the work. It was counterintuitive to keep herself so far from the wall instead of hugging it. But this was what her father had taught her. This is how you climb. She took another step, feeling the ice break through, feeling the weight of her body thrown sideways. She grabbed behind her for the rope in the harness to make sure she didn't fall, and held her breath as her body slammed against the ice. It was the 10th time this had happened, or maybe the 100th. Time had stopped. There was nothing but ice and rope and a slow but endless upward movement. "We're almost there," Nick said, just behind her. "We've got this." She looked down at him. Blood was running down the side of his face, from a cut on his eyebrow. He must have caught the ice the wrong way on one of his own body slams. Now he looked like a boxer who needed to be sent to a neutral corner to be checked by the doctor. Kate regained her footing against the ice, leaned her body back again, took a step, and then another. She saw her father looking down at her from the top of this wall. That meant the tower was close. It would be another chance to rest. When she was close enough to the top, her father reached down one hand to help her up. She brushed herself off as she stood up. Nick came up next, already pressing his glove against the cut on his eyebrow as Jake took out his first aid kit. Quentin came up last, breathing harder than all of them. The air was so cold up here, the wind bracing their faces, and it was so high. They were approaching 2 miles above sea level. No wonder they were moving so slowly. Their lungs were starving for oxygen. "Time for the tanks," Jake said. They had each packed a 1-liter canister of 95% pure oxygen, and now they all took this moment to put them to their mouths and inhale. "How much farther?" Kate asked between long breaths. Her father nodded his head in the direction behind her. She turned and looked up. There was one more tower above them. Then above that, the abandoned Fergan Monastery. "The last leg is always the hardest," Jake reminded them. "You're tired. You're sloppy. The thin air is making you loopy. Just stay focused for a few more minutes." They stopped to rest one more time when they reached the last tower. A bulge in the mountain was hiding the monastery from them, but they knew it was there, waiting in frozen silence. God knew how long it had been since anyone else had been up here. Jake set the course for the last section, including one last wall of ice that seemed to tilt back past vertical. He waited at the crest, helped each of the rest of them climb over those last scary few feet when it felt like one slip would mean a fall into an endless void. As Kate stood up, she looked at her father. He had done most of the hard work on this climb, and now his face was drained of color. "You need to take the rest of my air," Kate said to him. "I'm okay," he said. "Almost there." He turned to look up at the monastery, in plain view now that they had cleared this last wall. Kate looked in the same direction, transfixed by the sight of the empty building. It was covered by a thick sheet of ice, even thicker than the photographs had suggested, and in some spots the roof had given way beneath the weight. Nick came to stand next to her, then Quentin. Finally, Jake. The cold air whipped past them. They all stared at the half-ruined monastery, framed against the western sky by the sharp peak of the Matterhorn. "Welcome to Switzerland," Jake said. "I think we crossed the border a few minutes ago." "Looks like a good place to film a horror movie," Nick said. "At least it's empty," Quentin said. "We had to climb a mountain to do it, but we won't have company this time." He was still breathing hard. The mountain had been tougher on him than anyone else. He took out his oxygen canister and put it to his mouth. "Let's go find this thing," Kate said. "I'm gonna stay here with Quentin for a minute," Jake said. "You guys go ahead." Nick and Kate left them there and walked up the last 100 feet to the monastery. The only sounds were the whistling of the wind and the crunch of their boots on the hard crust of snow and ice. "Something associated with fire," Nick said, "or with light. That's what we're looking for, right?" Kate didn't respond. She was looking up at the ice on the roof as they approached the doorway. It was at least 2 feet thick, and it looked ready to either slide down and crush them, or else bring down the roof and collapse the old wooden walls. Nick kicked away some of the loose snow in front of the door and tried to open it, but it wouldn't budge. "Be careful," she said. Nick gathered himself and then rammed his shoulder into the door. Kate closed her eyes and held her breath as it crashed open, but the ice stayed on the roof. She followed Nick inside the building, into what appeared to have been the kitchen. After all of the brilliant white snow that had surrounded them outside, it was dark here, and Kate's eyes took a moment to adjust. As they did, she saw 2 windows, one on either side of the room, but they were fogged with age and half covered with ice. "Not exactly the Ritz-Carlton," Nick said, taking out his flashlight. A high wooden work table stood in the center of the room. Along one wall was an ancient metal sink with no faucet. Next to that was a larder that had once kept food, now holding only dust and an old flour bag. Then cupboards and a few drawers containing tarnished silverware. Along another wall was an ancient wood stove. "Fire," Nick said. "We may have something here." He shined his light on the cast iron surface of the stove, then bent down close to examine it. Kate stepped through into the next room and saw that half of the roof had caved in here. She took a few cautious steps, feeling the cold air creeping in from above her. This room was larger than the kitchen, with a great table and at least 20 chairs. It was hard to say for sure because the table itself had been destroyed by the great slab of ice, and most of the chairs had been reduced to kindling. There was a stone fireplace in the corner of the room. The hole in the roof gave her enough light to see by, but she took out her flashlight anyway so she could closely scan every inch of every stone. The cold air kept creeping in, and it seemed to wrap itself around her neck. She had this strange, impossible feeling that someone was watching her. "Kate, come see this." When she went into the kitchen, she saw that Nick had pulled open a large trap door in the wooden floor. "This place must be built on a ledge," Nick said, shining his flashlight down a rough wooden stairway. "It's 2 stories high on the back." "What do you think they kept down there?" she asked. "Just a few boxes, far as I can see," Nick said. "They might have kept their food down here. Maybe wine, you know, for communion or big parties on the weekend." The cold air from the other room had seemed to follow Kate, was still wrapping itself around her neck. "Are you getting a strange feeling?" she asked quietly. Nick had already taken his first tentative step down the rickety stairway. "So it's not just me?" "No, it's not just you." Quentin was sitting on a mound of hard ice, drawing in one breath after another from his oxygen canister. Jake stood next to him, one hand on one knee, the other hand holding his own canister against his mouth. With the kids gone, he didn't have to pretend not to be feeling this through every inch of his body. "I've been on mountains before," Quentin said when he was done with his oxygen. "I don't remember it being this hard." "When was the last time you were 2 miles up?"
2 miles of elevation? Damn.
"Probably 20 years ago."
"There's your problem," Jake said. "They took out most of the oxygen since then."
Both men started laughing. Quentin reached up a hand. Jake took it and helped him up. After brushing themselves off, they headed toward the building. Nick and Kate had split off to the right side of the building's exterior, so Jake and Quentin went left. They found another door, pushed it open, and turned on their flashlights. It was a large room with bunk beds lined up in 2 rows, as in an army barracks, but now most of the beds had fallen apart. "I'm having flashbacks to recruit training," Jake said, kicking a board out of his way. "Although I'd take Paris Island over this place right now." Another great stone fireplace was centered on one wall. Both men stepped closer to run their hands over the stones. "Probably a fireplace in every room," Jake said. Quentin nodded. Then both men looked up as they heard the distinctive sounds of wood cracking. "Lot of weight up there," Quentin said, eyeing the ceiling. "I'm surprised the stone fireplaces aren't the only things left standing. It's been abandoned for what? 70 years? I'm sure it'll hold for one more day." Quentin left Jake at the fireplace and walked through the rest of the sleeping quarters to the next room. Here the roof had partially collapsed along one wall, but without giving way completely to the outside elements. He had to duck as he stepped around the bowed-in ceiling. The room was filled with 2 dozen old pews, many of them toppled over. An elaborately carved wooden lectern stood at the opposite end, the focal point of everyone who had once sat in the pews. Quentin approached the lectern and ran his gloved fingers over the carvings. There was a cross in the center. No surprise in a monastery. And yet it wasn't elongated like most Christian crosses. It was squared off, more like a plus sign, and it was fixed inside a circle. A vague sense of unease had been growing in Quentin ever since he had entered this structure. Now that feeling was even more pervasive than the cold air. "What was this place?" he asked out loud. Quentin spotted a door leading to another room. He went to the door, pushed it open, and looked inside. Kate watched Nick negotiate the wooden stairs to the room below, then turned on her own flashlight and followed him. The stairs creaked and groaned as she took each step, until suddenly she felt herself plunge through. Nick barely caught her, wrapping his hands around her torso and holding her there, suspended over an 8-foot drop. As they caught their breath, they were both aware of how close together their faces were.
"Another romantic moment," Nick said. "We do know how to find them."
They got down the rest of the stairs without incident, coming to rest on a rough stone floor. With no windows on this floor, their flashlight beams barely pierced the darkness.
"There's the ledge this thing is built on," Nick said, playing his flashlight across the exposed rock that formed one wall of the room. Somehow, it made this lower level feel even colder, like the mountain itself was draining any last heat from the air.
"It's like a charming split-level ranch," Nick said, "with a great view. I'm thinking of putting in an offer."
Nick's flashlight settled on an old wooden crate with barely visible German words written across it. He went over to the crate and pushed it a few inches. It was empty. Kate found a similar crate, then another. Each was empty, and another two were smashed open.
"Time out," Nick said as he kicked another crate. This one didn't feel hollow. He dragged the crate across the rough stones, then shined his light along the top edges. He took out his knife and tried to work it around the edges.
"You got a better knife on you?"
"You're not using my Ontario knife as a crowbar," she said. "I'll go find something in the kitchen." She went back to the stairs and climbed out of the trapdoor. When she opened the old cupboards and drawers, the best tool she could find was an old paring knife with a wooden handle. As she was sliding the drawer shut, she stopped dead.
"I'm being watched," she thought.
She whirled around to see nothing but an empty ancient kitchen. Almost as if to prove something to herself, she went to one window and rubbed it with her sleeve until she could look out. She saw only the ice and snow on the front side of the building, with her own footprints mixed in with those of her father, Nick and Quentin. She went to the back window, rubbed it with her sleeve as she had done with the first, then peered through the window. It took her a full 5 seconds to process what she was seeing. Oh my God.
Jake caught up to Quentin and stood next to him in the doorway.
"What are we looking at here?" Jake asked.
"I'm going to say it was once a library," Quentin said. He took a step into the room, immediately putting both boots on old paper. The shelves that lined every wall had once held thousands of books, but now every single one of them had been thrown to the floor, and most of them were torn into pieces. He picked up one page to read it. The words were German. In the corner was yet another stone fireplace. Jake moved closer and shined his flashlight on the stones. Quentin went to the small writing desk that had been built into one of the bookshelves. The chair had been smashed into pieces. Quentin opened a drawer and found letters that were now little more than faded ink on brittle paper. At the top of one sheet of paper was a letterhead with the same symbol he had seen on the lectern in the other room, a square cross over a circle.
"What kind of monastery was this?" he asked.
"Maybe it wasn't," Jake said. "Just because they called it a monastery doesn't mean they were up here saying their vespers. Who knows what they were doing?"
"I'm getting a bad feeling about this place," Quentin said.
"You and me both, brother. How about we find the next link so we can get the hell out of here?" Quentin came over to the fireplace, nearly falling when the remains of a book he stepped on slid from under him. He caught himself, kicking at the papers under his feet.
"What is this?"
He got down on one knee and moved more of the paper aside with his hand. There was a pattern built into the wooden floor, like spokes emanating from the hub of a wheel. Jake came over and helped him clear more of the floor. There were 12 spokes in all, and each took a sharp jag to the right before it reached the outer circle.
"You ever seen something like this before?"
"Yes," Quentin said, "I have. It's called the Black Sun. I saw one like this at a gallery in Wavelsberg. They held an auction for some old SS artifacts there, which I decided I couldn't be a part of, no matter how much I was being paid."
"SS? As in Heinrich Himmler's old gang?"
"One and the same.
So what is this doing here?"
The two men looked at each other, sharing the same chill down their spines.
They both stood up and were about to leave the room when Quentin put a hand on Jake's arm.
Wait a minute, he said. Fire. Light.
What about it? Name the one thing that's hot and bright, more than anything else.
The sun, Jake said, looking at the design at his feet.
The black sun, Quentin said. They both got back on their knees, pushing the debris away. Jake trained his flashlight on the floor as Quentin used two fingers to brush away the last shreds of paper from the very axis point of the black sun design. Both men bent down even farther to peer at the symbol that was uncovered. A tiny swastika. The symbol was centered in a circle of wood embedded in the floor, about 2 feet in diameter. Jake started to feel around for the edge and was about to take out his knife when Quentin stopped him.
I've seen something like this before, Quentin said.
See how those spokes jag to the right?
Yes.
Watch, Quentin said, putting both hands on the disc and pushing clockwise. It took a moment and a little more muscle to get it moving, but then the disc broke free. Quentin pushed down on one side to get the other to rise, worked his fingers underneath and lifted it from the floor. There was a round chamber underneath, just a few inches in depth, plenty deep enough to hold a single piece of paper, facing up. It was the last link in the map. It took Kate a full 5 seconds to process what she was seeing out the back window. Vehicles. Large, green, boxy vehicles with treads instead of wheels. Snowcats. She was looking down on top of them, here on the backside of the building where the window was higher. The vehicles looked vintage. They must be old, she told herself. Must have been abandoned here for decades. Her mind demanded this, because nothing else would make sense. But no, they were in the open area behind the monastery, unsheltered, with no snow or ice covering them. Behind the vehicles, she spotted the fresh tracks leading away to the northwest. She was sure she would have heard these snowcats arriving. But she hadn't. They were already here, she thought, waiting for us. Quentin held the paper as Jake shined his flashlight on it. It was the same basic design as the others, with vague topographic lines marked with a dozen ancient runes. To the right of those, in a separate banner, was another string of words in German.
Der Zug fährt auf Haubestrecke zum Bahnhof Strebske Plessa.
The words meant nothing to Jake or Quentin. They'd have to take this back down to Professor Lewis. Lewis told us that this link was different from the others, Jake said.
He did.
Are you starting to get the feeling that this one's different because... How do I even say this? Because it brought us here?
This monastery feels like it must have belonged to the Brotherhood, Quentin said.
Is that what you're saying? Yes, Jake said, which means that the map may have been created here, so that the different links would lead back here.
There's no place like home, Quentin said, although this sure as hell isn't Kansas.
A voice came from behind them.
No, we're a long way from Kansas, Toto.
Jake and Quentin both stood up. In the doorway was a man wearing a fur-lined parka. He had thin blonde hair, almost white, with intense blue eyes behind rimless glasses. Beside him stood Franz, the giant they had thrown from the train. Franz had a patch over one of his eyes and bruises of every color all over his face. But he was very much alive, and he was currently holding a Heckler & Koch MP7 submachine gun, which looked like a toy in the man's giant hands.
Did I get that right? The man in the glasses asked, with a pronounced German accent.
I don't watch many American films.
Who are you? Quentin asked, even though he could take a good guess.
My name is Klaus Egger, the man said. You've already met my lieutenant, Franz.
You're the leader of the Brotherhood, Quentin said.
At your service, Egger said,
as Franz leveled the barrel of the submachine at Quentin's chest.
Now if you'll hand me that last link. And all of the others, please.